UMass fans on your tweets and make some noise for your podcaster.
Well, can you believe what's going on in the Atlantic 10 today?
I remember, man, when
Penn State was in the Atlantic 10.
And he rips him down, he puts him in his seat, and he looks at him and goes, "That was fucking hilarious, but you really just gotta shut up."
I think I'd rather die in nuclear war than go to Olympics.
All right. My name is Corey Hicks Sage. I wasn't exactly sure how I was going to do the show tonight because I joined a Dayton pod this week, which I've actually asked for permission to include or had asked for permission to include and make basically our show. And then I was going to throw a little mailbag segment and a short intro on top of it. But then I recorded the mailbag segment, and I'll be honest, it went really long. It was like a 55-minute mailbag segment, which touched on anything I would have touched on and more in the intro, and in many ways touched on some of the touched on some of the themes I talked about with Sully in our 50-minute interview yesterday. So instead of making this like a 2-hour endless episode, what I'm going to do is send the audio to Bennett with this intro and all the caveats up front, and then I'm going to encourage you, if you haven't already, to listen to the Blackburn Review podcast. It's linked on my Twitter. You can find the link on Curry Hicks Age, or you can check out Sully, my good name, the Dayton blogger who does a great job, who came on our show earlier in the year, and so I went on his show yesterday. So listen to that if you want more on the Dayton game in particular and a little bit more about kind of the course of the UMass program. I kind of talked about some of our broader structural challenges as a program. And then this episode is going to be exclusively maybe the first ever mailbag only segment, but I think that you'll enjoy it because the questions that we tackled really touched on every aspect of the program, where things are headed, and I think served as kind of a good late February type of episode in that, let's be honest, like we're playing out the string here. We're waiting to get maybe a flash of excitement in Brooklyn in 2.5 weeks. And anything that was discussed was in many ways should be about the future and kind of the broader dynamics surrounding the program. So I hope you'll enjoy it. Like, subscribe, all that stuff. And as Cal would say, we love you. And Cal's not with us. Obviously, he hasn't been in some time. And we will return. I don't know. We'll return soon. We'll hopefully return. We'll do something next week, particularly if UMass has a modestly successful or encouraging week with Dayton and Duquesne this weekend, respectively. All right. Okay, time for a mailbag segment, and let's begin. And I'll be totally candid, I was aggressively soliciting questions because I wanted to do one, and I kind of asked impromptu, and then got a bunch of stuff eventually, so I'm going to do it, but I apologize for the, I was a little thirsty, if you will. I just wanted to do it, and I started tagging people, and, you know, so it was a little aggressive there. Okay, Maroon Mafia, Matt Zeke Z 2003 from Chicopee, Mass on Twitter says, "I have seen comments that the team might be better without Pip. In my opinion, I'd say that's false. What are your thoughts about that?" I have toyed and wrestled with this question in my mind at decent length, and I have concluded that I don't really know, and I'm going to make the case on both sides and then maybe talk myself into one or the other. If you look at what Luan did last season, you realize it was one of the most astonishingly impressive single seasons offensively in the history of UMass basketball. the numbers bear it out and the results bear it out. Even though they only won 13 games, you realize, like, wow, they won 13 games, which is more than they have this year, against a better A-10 with quite literally one half the number of scholarship players as they have this year, which brings into focus just how impressive that season was. So you do have to think holistically and look at what he did last year. But the truth is he's regressed this year. And though he averages, I believe, 16.6 a game, I suspect that number in a 10 play is closer to 13. He's also missed, I think at this point, four games and is expected to miss Dayton. And he's shooting, I believe, 34%? Is that possible? 34% from three, maybe? I saw that figure the other day. I don't have it in front of me. But it's bad. I mean, it seems like every night when he does play, it's 5 for 16, 4 for 15, and he dribbles a lot. You know, I don't have a grasp of advanced analytics in the way I'd like, but I know enough to be able to say, and I'm sure it's borne out by statistical backing, that he is an inefficient offensive player. He has not been getting people involved in kind of the seamless fashion you would want. It's a lot of dribbles. He does have good assist numbers still, but and he's not a pure point guard. So I think if Luan does return, and I'll be totally candid, based on sources I've spoken with and sort of what I'm seeing in general, I have reason to believe he will not return. But if he does return, I would like it to be with a true, pure point guard alongside of him who is very effective at finding not only Luan but others in the right spots. And it remains to be seen, I think, at this point, whether or not Trey Wood or Keon Clairgeau can emerge in that role. Now, as I'm saying that, I'm also realizing that in the event Pip does come back, and in the event those other two individuals, Clairgeau and Wood, come back, well, you sort of have a repeat of what you have this year in terms of Pip's going to play, and so that's going to either limit the development or the playing time of one of those two other players. And so maybe as I'm saying all this, I'm realizing maybe he doesn't. Maybe it's better without him. I mean, they've played. Did he play against Davidson? I don't think he did, right? Yeah, I don't think he did. And he didn't play against St. Joe's, and he didn't play in the impressive loss against Mason. He did play that one game against GW, which was a disaster, and he didn't play against Fordham, but that was just a disaster regardless. There's a real case that maybe it's time to move on. And it's not that he's not a super talented player, it's that I think he sucks up a lot of the oxygen on this team and limits other guys from getting involved. And I think the emergence and extended minutes for guys like Samba Diallo, Keon Clairgeau, even to a degree Unique McLean, has provided this team with a little bit more balance than it had when Pip was there. But the real question for me with Pip is, and I've heard varying answers on this front from sources I speak with who are more closely connected to the program, is what is he like in the locker room? And I think ultimately that's sort of what it comes down to. If he's genuinely bought into what McCall's looking to do in the same way that it appears clear that a Carl Pierre and Clairgeau and I think Baptiste, I think those three probably are the most bought in. If Pip can get closer to that, or it's clear that he's going to sort of be that guy or among those guys, then I think you can't cast away a guy like that. If he's not, and he's going to be so ball dominant that it limits the development and playing time of others, then it might be time to move on. And that's not an indictment of Luan. I think he said it, done some unbelievable things here, and I mean, he's like the 13th leading scorer in program history in 3 years. I mean, you know, that's super impressive. Like, and last year was one of the greatest seasons I've ever seen. So I don't want to just cast him aside. But given all the factors I you know, set forth, it seems if he's not locked into what McCall's trying to do from an internal culture standpoint, and that might mean less touches, then it's probably time to cut ties, which is what I'm being told is likely going to happen anyway, and maybe that's informing my surprisingly, not negative, but maybe not as predictable of an opinion as some in the fan base might expect. So, next question comes from Matthew Parent, good friend of the show, says, does your presence provide the necessary spark for a victory? How much credit do you take for the wins? I can't take any credit in all seriousness, but I think in part I've been to a couple of Saturday afternoon games, and the Mullins is pretty good on Saturday afternoons, so much better than the weeknight games, that in general the team is better on those days. They lost to LaSalle in conference on one of those Saturday games, but since I think they've won three straight, and if you look at it, their home losses in league, if I'm not mistaken, have, other than the LaSalle game, which was like actually a very good defensive effort, they just couldn't score. Other than that, I think the three losses, which have been bad, Bonaventure by double figures, Fordham by double figures, and somebody else, have all been weeknight contests in front of a dreary, dull, morgue-esque Mullen Center. What game am I missing? I'll find it in the schedule here. But yeah, I mean, I think part of it's just that I think this team in particular, where they don't, you know, McCall talks a lot about culture, and I think what a lot of that means is that, like, when you're trying to create a culture, you need guys to just, there has to be a certain amount of intrinsic motivation. You can't just rely on atmosphere and kind of opponent or whatever. You got to just know how to take care of business. And I think when McCall, you know, I'm reading between the lines, obviously, but I think when he talks about the struggles from that vantage point, one of the things is creating their own kind of motivation. And so, and they struggle with that. And that's, I think there is, I mean, I don't know how you'd ever quantify it, but I really do believe there's like a correlation between the dull atmosphere at the Mullen Center on weeknights and this team's performance in those games. I really believe that. Because if you look, they've played basically well, and certainly from an effort standpoint, well, in every in-conference weeknight game at the Mullen Center, and basically done the opposite in those weekday contests. So I guess the other loss was George Mason, which was also a weekday, and they actually played fairly well there, but you sort of get what I'm saying. So no, I don't think it's me. Although it was a pleasure to be courtside, and I had a lot of fun, but and there certainly were instances where I'm going to delude myself into believing that I convinced Unique or Jonathan Laurent to lock in even more on defense, but no, in all seriousness, no. Okay, a few questions from the great R. Sitchman. He says, can Baptiste play one more year? Yeah, he can. I'm not sure if he just doesn't know that, or, but yeah, he has enough full year of eligibility. Chances we win out. We'd have to win four in a row against Dayton at home, Duquesne on the road, Richmond at home, Rhode Island on the road. I would say, without doing the actual math, 5% or less. But I wouldn't be stunned if we beat Dayton, and I wouldn't be, I mean, all those games are ostensibly winnable, but the way you, I mean, we've also lost to Fordham by 20, so how do you predict it with this team? Next thing he asks is, who do you want Day, as in Dayton, 1/2 path? I'm not sure what he's referring to, so I'm going to move on. Maybe something about the A-10 tournament, not quite sure. Thoughts regarding Unique 2.0. This, of course, refers to the newly invigorated over the last four or five games, Unique McClain. So, and there's another question I think about this in the mailbag tonight that I'll get to in a moment, but what I've said on Unique McClain remains basically the same as what I've said on him his entire time at UMass. Unique McClain, and it's almost like a meme at this point, it's a trope. Unique McClain is a unique player. That's the only way I can describe it. I was sitting courtside, and one of the great pleasures of doing that is, and it's actually kind of difficult at points to see, follow certain things from the game, because you're almost like looking up. And one of the challenges, you know, one of the unique things about watching Unique is that if you watch him, and McCall's talked about this, I've never seen, he doesn't say it, it's quite the words I'm going to say it in, but he tacitly alludes to it. I've never seen a guy whose body language is as indifferent and just uninterested, seemingly uninterested in being there as I have with Unique McClain. He literally, like when they won, go watch the tape of when they win on the final possession. You see Keon like just overcome with emotion in a really good way. The guys are celebrating. Unique McClain is just like casually sauntering off the court. Not even sauntering, like just walking. Like, now, I say that because that actually doesn't characterize the things he does on the floor at all. You would think a guy like that would be constantly getting beat back door, and, you know, he's at times, until recently, prior to recently, shown a propensity not to be the best perimeter defender in the world, and probably has gotten beat back door a number of times, but he's also, like, at least once or twice a game, comes out of absolute nowhere and just dunks a ball off a rebound that you're just like, I didn't know he was even on the same end of the court. He does just gravity-defying heroics at least once or twice a game, and you look at the box score and you're like, oh, he had like 8 rebounds? What? Like he had, you know, 2 steals? Whatever it is. And so it's strange because when he touches the ball, you know he can't really shoot it still. But, you know, he's not going to just, like, take a dude off the dribble. But get him a little space and a catch with a step on a guy, and he's liable to just dunk over anyone in the country. Like, yes, I think he's providing better minutes than Curtis Cobb was. I think he's providing better minutes than maybe Kieran Hayward would provide, particularly from a defensive and rebounding perspective. I think he's, with Pip out, I think those minutes are nice, but you can't, if Unique is not there next year, there will be moments where I'm like, I don't want to say his energy, but I miss his just ability. Like, when he had that dunk the other day, it energized the team. Like, it's not his energy, it's the ability of particular Unique McClain plays to energize others, which I guess is his energy. But what I'm saying is, it's not like he comes on there and he's getting the crowd fired up and he's, like, visibly emphatic, right? He's just this dude who periodically does these really unique things that can, at least for moments, change a game. So I've been pleased, you know, for sure, but I don't think he's a piece around which you can substantively build your future. If he wants to stick around and play sparingly as he did at the beginning of the year, then great. But if he wants to play more extended minutes, then maybe he's not back. I also think he may be graduating because, remember, he sat out that year, Kellogg's last year. He redshirted, so he may have been able to graduate in 3. I don't know. But between all the summer sessions and all that, you know, it's possible. I think it should be noted that, and I think maybe McCall in retrospect probably realizes this, but probably made the mistake of not getting Unique involved enough at the beginning of the season. He was often just playing, you know, 2 minutes or not at all for a long stretch there in November, December, if I went back to the box score. And so you have to wonder, in McCall's effort to involve the transfers and kind of get those guys acclimated, whether Unique was maybe mistakenly left to flounder a bit And now as he's been given those extended minutes, it sort of serves as like a little bit of a catch-up, a de facto like catch-up for those, all the minutes he lost. So, you know, but again, it's weird because to just kind of wrap this one up on Unique, it's strange in that he's basically ineffective when he doesn't get a lot of minutes, like 25 plus minutes, it seems. When he does get those minutes, he makes some spectacular plays, but is he good enough that you want a guy like that getting 25 minutes? Probably not. And yet, if he only gets 10 or 15 minutes, he's shown himself not to really be effective at all. So it's a weird spot for, I think, McCall to be in. Again, Unique McLean is a unique basketball player. And Sitchman asks, Carl is back, right? And I think the answer is yes. And I think part of that is because, I think it's clear, he's the focal point of the offense now with both Cobb and Pip out. Let's not forget the Cobb factor too. I mean, those are two guys who combined early in the season at points. The two of them were getting, I mean, there were probably instances of those two getting close to 30 shots a night, certainly 25. And I think Carl's ability, you know, if you recall the George Mason game where he was like 10 for 20, like I like that. I like that a lot. Carl's a shooter and you got to get him a lot of shots. And, you know, it's not like he's inefficient in getting those shots. Like he's catch and shoot, you know, one or two dribbles to the rim. And he's also gotten a lot better penetration. So I really like what Carl's been able to do. And I liked the ability in the St. Joe's game with the reemergence of Jonathan Laurent to have two guys who are kind of between 6'4 and 6'7, like sort of long, a two and a three man who can, you know, both shoot and go to the rim. I think those two, Jonathan Laurent, I wish someone asked me a question about him tonight, but boy, that's a guy where you're like, man, you could build a team around him and Carl Pierre, and then he'll just disappear for four games, and you're like, maybe you can't, you know? So, but I certainly liked Laurent and Pierre, you know, in your, you know, around the perimeter and slashing and shooting probably much more than I think basically any other guard duo. Of course, Laurent was like kind of playing the five at point, so I wouldn't call him a guard, but he did play at the perimeter, so if that makes sense. Okay, P. Veal 7, Pat says, I think the culture change, puts it in quotes, stuff is stupid. Shouldn't have done that right away. Not the second. Shouldn't he have done that right away? Not the second half of year two. But did McCall wait too long to shorten the bench and go with guys who fit his style? Injuries have necessitated a bit, but he used the same five for the entire second half. So he's saying a few things here. Let's break it down piece by piece. I think McCall's, in fairness, been stressing the culture thing all along. I think that he has started to lean on it more in the post-game pressers and in assorted remarks to the local media, in part as a public relations strategy, just in the sense that you have to give people hope that you're moving things forward. And I think the way to do that is to just talk about commitment to culture, and because that's a longer term and it's kind of a more vague thing than like we need to get to 13 wins this year or whatever. So some of it's just, you know, a little bit political. But I do believe that McCall earnestly believes it, and I think he's right. And I think maybe, and I think he's alluded to this himself, that maybe he not de-emphasized it, but it was such a point of emphasis in the offseason. And then I think maybe in the early going and in the non-conference, he didn't raise the red flags as I think he maybe attributed struggles in the non-conference to kind of the natural evolution of a team with a bunch of new parts rather than a function of, you know, an internal culture that wasn't right. And so I think once he was like, fuck it, it's all about the culture, then he just sort of did that in a good way at the expense of like whatever else he was working on. Like, we've got to get that first. So yeah, maybe he took the, you know, his foot off the gas a little on that front in the non-conference, and maybe that hurt them heading into conference. But it's better late than never, right? And I think he's always emphasized it to a degree, so I don't have a huge problem with that. As for the second part of the question, did McCall wait too long to shorten the bench and go with guys who fit his style? Probably. Yeah, I think probably. I think this, but, so it's interesting. I was going to say probably, but then I thought back again, and this is just like sticking in my brain more than a lot of things this year, is the confounding play of Jonathan Laurent. Because I was like, I don't know how many games it's been, but until the St. Joe's game, I was like, for the last five or six, I want to say, I was like, Laurent just disappeared. I don't know what happened. And Matt hadn't been playing him as well, so I'm like, okay, he made the right move by shortening his bench. Well, then he brings him back into that game. He scores 24 points on 9 of 13 shooting. So you're like, and that was after he shortened the bench. And maybe he only plays that much because now you have Cobb and Pip both out. So yeah, I do think he waited too long. I think the signs, I should be totally candid here. The fading of Cobb began fairly early. He had a great second half against Providence, and I guess he probably had a couple other performances, but certainly by the beginning of conference play, I feel like it was clear that like he wasn't helping. Pip, you know, puts you in that uncomfortable spot because he does get you points, but I don't think McCall should have ever like stopped playing Pip, but I think maybe he should have stopped giving him 35 minutes. There was that slump, that awful slump for Pip before he ultimately had the hamstring injury. But you know, so I would shorten the bench with him, but I would say get other guys involved and not play Pip as much. 4, 5, 6 guys down the stretch. But if you look at like the first half of those games, a lot of guys got minutes and there were some fluctuations game to game. I mean, Kieran Hayward would get a bunch of minutes randomly, or Unique would. And so he didn't, now that I'm walking myself through this, a little bit reject the premise just because he's limited the bench in particular games, but not necessarily overall, because you'll see like Rashawn will play 28 minutes against St. Joe's on the road, and then like 3 minutes at Ford against Fordham the next night, you know? So, yeah. You know, but he's, and at a certain level, you've got three guys out now with injuries. And no, I mean, he hasn't really shortened the bench. It's just in particular games he shortens it. So like Chapman played a bunch the other day, but he probably didn't a couple days before. Like who has had demonstrably less minutes other than Laurent pre St. Joe's game? I guess. Because, I mean, Hayward didn't play at all at the beginning of the year. He plays now. Unique didn't play at all at the beginning of the year. He plays now. It's just that minutes have, you know, Cobb is not playing. Turner Morris, not that he played a lot, isn't playing. And Pip isn't playing. So it just, but yeah, he certainly has shortened it for the home stretches of particular games. And then the last part of that question was, that was basically it. And then Pat asks another question and says, he finds an old tweet of mine from February 7th. And it was a tweet in which I had rejected the premise of Unique's improvement. I said, he hasn't actually been very good. Sorry, not sorry. He said, do you want to walk back this tweet regarding Unique at all? He plays hard, mostly in control and within his means, and is good for one whoa moment momentum play per game. And I think that we're on the same page now. I mean, I think I alluded to this in with Sitch's question. Yeah, like that's sort of what I said with regard to Sitch, you know, that question. Like he does have those incredible moments. He does play hard, although it doesn't always look like it. That's just a Unique thing about Unique. He's certainly in control, mostly in control and within his means. I think the operative phrase there is within his means. And that kind of gets at that whole point I was making, which is like, is that a piece that, I mean, it's like, let's be honest, it's a ruthless industry, right? And it is an industry. Is there another piece you can get, either a freshman who you can develop or a fifth-year transfer that makes more sense than Unique? You know, again, I think that if Unique could kind of do the stuff he does in 25 minutes a little bit more in 10 or 15, then he's an absolutely wonderful bench player. But we've seen that was not the case. And so, I don't know, it's just a unique thing about Unique. But so I'll walk back that he hasn't actually been very good. I mean, he hasn't been very good, but I'll say like he's contributed a lot more for sure. And then Pat also asks, can you use your pull with UMass AD Bamford to go full rebrand next year? Give me Massachusetts on the jerseys, just like hockey. All the other sports use the still fire script U in the 90s when hoops was king. Hockey is it now, and their unis are tight. P.S. Where can I buy one? Apparently, they are really nice looking. Apparently, they're going to start selling them soon. I hope that's the case. I don't exhaust a great deal of psychic energy over uniform stuff. I don't know. But I do think the Massachusetts stuff is really legit. But I also think, I don't know, let's get back to UMass first and away from UMass Amherst before we make the full leap to Massachusetts. Like, let's just, because if you're an undergrad at UMass today, like, these fuckers think they go to UMass Amherst. If they're not big sports fans or, like, tapped into the, what is ultimately a fairly small Twitter sphere of UMass Twitter, a lot of these kids think they go to UMass Amherst. They don't, even some of the guys who are on UMass Twitter who are, like, in college right now, they don't care about that. So we got to continue picking that battle before we move on to the Massachusetts one. Eric Friedlander. Fittingly enough, Eric, I think, is the current undergrad to which I was alluding when I said they don't really care about the UMass Amherst thing. Great kid, but he and I part ways on that point. He says, is there a recruit that got away that to this day you think what could have been? It's a good question because there's been a lot, but you never know because, like, hindsight is 20/20. If you're really down to, and also you never really know how much you were just, like, recruiting is a strange world. And from what my sources have told me and what I've kind of observed is sometimes a player will basically do a program a favor by keeping them in the final two or three or four or whatever so that it will sort of enhance the perception of the program. And they'll do that because maybe, I think, for example, Kevin Jones, who I think went on to be like one of the leading all-time scorers at West Virginia. The story was that, this is many years back, UMass Hoops readers will recall that his brother was a football player at UMass, like in the 90s. And so it was said to be down to UMass and West Virginia. But you don't know if that's just his brother doing a solid for the university because he's loyal to it, you know? So that's why I say, like, you don't really know who the ones that truly got away were. I will say right now, one comes to mind is the kid Lofton, who's absolutely tearing it up as a freshman at St. Bonaventure. He damn near came to UMass last year, but we had already signed Trey Wood, and so I think he didn't want to be, competing with another freshman for minutes. But, man, he's pretty special, and that's, you know, got to be considered a miss. Trying to think of some others. Some people get bent out of shape about local kids who went away, but I don't particularly care about that. And I'll be honest, there's so many people who do a nice job on both Twitter and the message boards of tracking recruiting that it's sort of like not something I get super caught up in. And I guess the other one I'm thinking of, if it's in fact true, was the kid Bruce Brown ended up at Miami. Massachusetts kid who was apparently down to UMass in Miami, and I think he's in the NBA now, so, yeah. Brian Long, Intervisions 33, asks, what do you see the roster being next year? Well, Holloway's gone. They've already signed three guys, so that means that there's at least two who are gone in addition to that. You have to assume that one is Cobb because he can graduate and go somewhere else, and McCall's sort of alluded to it. You have to assume another is, and like, I know these are sensitive subjects, and you know, if players or their families or whatever are listening right now, like, I don't mean to speculate, I don't mean to take lightly this, but the truth is, like, this is the game, this is the business, and you have to read the tea leaves, and that's what I'm doing as a fan, so it's not personal. It's just what I'm seeing and sensing. But it would seem like Cobb is gone. And then for the third departure, because you know there's at least three, and I've already mentioned Holloway graduate. I don't see Clergo will be back. Baptiste will be back because those guys have already transferred. And they're not, and Baptiste already graduated from Vandy. Laurent is an interesting one because he could probably graduate because he's in his fourth year of college, so he could go somewhere else, a third school. But he sure played like he wanted to be here the other day, and you know, that'll be interesting. And then you know, I presume the freshman will be back, and Carl will be back. So that's sort of where I see it. And it would be really interesting to see what McCall feels he needs for if more people leave, then, you know, if there's additional availability, it'd be interesting to see if he goes with another freshman or brings in like a fifth year transfer who can play immediately, or a guy who graduated who has 2 years of eligibility left. That'll be really interesting to see. Brian also asks, having sat front row, are there any upgrades you can see to the fan experience? Well, I'm not sure I would be able to see them merely by sitting front row. I think the fan experience is good right now. I think I don't get too consumed with that. I think ultimately, like, they do a good job. Those people work hard. It's just like not a point of emphasis for me. They've done a better job of getting people through the gates this year. The security's improved. But look, like, the best fan experience is a winning basketball team. Asks, how come your courtside seats move from one side of the court to the other at one point? We sat in the wrong seats. I guess there were two, like the number seat we had, there were one on one side and one on the other. We sat in the other, so then we moved, which was a tiny bit embarrassing. We moved it like maybe the second time out or something. Mike from UMassHoops.com asks, how many bad UMass fans have you blocked on Twitter? The answer is, I don't know, none. I threatened to block this dude the other day, whose name I won't mention here, and then I just was like, fuck it, I don't even care. I think I've blocked like maybe one or two. Yeah, it's probably about it. Like, if you're not a complete asshole and you don't, you know, like, just, I've muted a couple, I'll be honest. And some of those people are like nice people. They just like tweet about a lot of boring shit or don't have really interesting things to say. And, you know, I followed them like early on, and it's a little bit of a sucker for, you know, their support. So I haven't unfollowed, but I have muted. PD Buckets, the George Mason blogger, says, who you got in a fight, 10 Lawan Pipkinses or 3 Rashawn Holloways? I'm going with 10 Lawan Pipkinses, and it's a no-brainer because the first 3 or 4 Lawan Pipkinses would get really fucking exhausted and, I mean, excuse me, really, really just mauled by Rashawn. But Rashawn gets tired very easily, and Pip is a fighter. He's tough. And so at the end, let's say even if you only have like 2 Pips left to 1 Holloway, I think it's like they're going to just outwork him, and they're going to be in better shape, and that ultimately is going to lead to the downfall of the final Holloway and maybe 1 or 1.5 Pips still standing. Good, great question. One of the best we've ever had in this program. Jacko Envelopes O'Brien 1219 asks, can you speak a bit about Dejan Giroux and his recent success with Houston basketball? Yeah, I mean, I think Houston's like, what, 7-8 in the country now? And he's played really well the last 5 or 6 games. I saw him play a little bit, but against UConn and maybe somebody else. I mean, look, like, there's always going to be, I'd be lying if I said there isn't always going to be like a what if scenario. But once Kellogg was gone, it was clear that he wasn't returning. And so the question was it worth keeping Dejan Giroux was it worth keeping Kellogg just for Dejan Giroux? And I still believe, even now, after all that's gone on and all the struggles of the last 2 seasons, that the answer is no. I don't think you can structure a program around 1 or 2 recruits, particularly if it was in fact true that their academics were so, that his academics were, and I believe Bryson Gresham's academics were so dismal that they may not have been eligible sophomore year. I say that because, and I have no reason to believe that's, the reason I believe that could be true is because they sat out, not even on campus at Houston last year. They went to community college, so, and got their grades right. So that suggests that there were some academic issues, and those probably could have, may have lingered had, even had they stayed. But in a perfect world, you know, I mean, there's always a what if, yeah. I mean, but the reality is he wasn't going to play for anyone other than Derek Kellogg at UMass. I think that much was clear. And certainly after Pat Kelsey bailed, that much was just, you know, completely solidified. So it's, you know, in a crazy, you know, hypothetical world, like, would I have liked to see him under Matt McCall? Yeah, sure. I think he actually fits a lot of what McCall wants to do. I mean, he's a guard with length who can get to the rim, who can, you know, pass, and they're also lacking a true point guard at the moment. Not that he was a completely true point guard, but he did a lot of nice things. Like, I'd be lying if I said otherwise. But he has flaws too, and you know, you wonder how much of his success is a function of not having to be the guy. You know, that the Houston team is loaded. I never thought he was, and I know he was like a top 30 recruit in some services. I never thought he was that level of good. I thought he was fantastic and could be a kind of two-time all-league type player, but I didn't see him necessarily as such a game-changing, transcendent talent that it merited keeping a coach for, right? And so given that, you know, I'm happy for him. I hope he wins the national title, like, whatever, like, go out there and do it. But I don't think that you can, it ever made sense to, alter the course, to not alter the course of UMass basketball because of one particularly talented player. Let's see. McKinney asks about Trey Mitchell, the recruit from Woodstock Academy. That could be an entire episode because I don't want to fan the flames on this one. I don't have the sources yet to fully locked in. I've heard a lot of mixed things, different things about circumstances surrounding that utterly talented basketball player and whether he's coming to UMass, but I don't quite have a definitive read on the situation, and I am not quite prepared to speculate because of that. But he's really good. Be great to have him. Alex Silva, Marshmont 63, former guest of the show, BC and UMass fan. He says, like 30 minutes after the deadline. Oh, no, never mind, because I asked him and he said 30 minutes later. He says, since becoming the de facto leader of UMass Twitter and making connections with UMass coaches and administrators, do you find it harder to offer your true opinion of the team, the program, and the coaches? So first of all, I want to reject outright the premise of me as some sort of leader of UMass Twitter. I see UMass Twitter as a leaderless movement fueled by the spontaneous emotionality of many hundreds of fanatical diehards. I certainly do my best to fan those flames at times and to promote whatever sentiment emerges if I like it. But I don't know, I'm a little uncomfortable with that. Like, truly, I know I'm not trying to sound selfless because I can be a cocky shit in other realms of life. Actually, no, I'm probably cockiest in this realm of life, let's be honest. So I should just accept it, embrace it. But I don't. Like, I find the notion of a fan leader very strange, and like, it's just like, no, it's truly one of the reasons I like this world is like, it's a domain for people who share what is, let's be honest, a fairly niche interest to commune and get together and, you know, talk about a shared interest, and like, I have a lot of fun with that, and so I'm glad that the UMass Twitter thing has taken off, although I wasn't the first to use it. I forget who it was. I think it was Cal. I forget. So, but I will acknowledge and cop to the the fact that through this platform, I've had the good fortune of making connections with UMass coaches and administrators, as you mentioned. And yeah, there are instances in which I find it harder to offer my true opinion of the team. You'll notice I just sort of glided over one moments ago, if you were listening carefully. Because obviously, you know, this is not the Red Sox where there's 1,000 people paid to talk about it all the time. And I think that I'm not trying to like toot my own horn here, but it's become clear that people within the program or, you know, very close to it monitor what I say, and they monitor like a lot of what you guys say. It's not just me, and listen to this show. And that certainly probably tamps down to a degree, like maybe my most just completely irrational criticism. But like, let's be honest, I don't really hold anything back during games. Like, I really like Matt McCall, but like I've been very critical of him at points this year. I've been critical of, you know, people associated with the program, and I don't think it stopped me in game. I think it's probably, there's been instances where it stopped me in show, if that makes sense. Not even stop me, but just maybe like made me actually, God forbid, like think through what the hell I'm saying. So, it's made it a little bit more difficult, but ultimately, like, no. And I think any credibility or what little of it I've ever had is like still dependent on candor and being honest. And I mean, I've gone back and forth a little with, you know, the SID this year, the sports information director. And again, if they do listen to the show, like, they should know, like, truly, I'm saying this truly, I have no interest in anything other than UMass being a winning program and being honest and candid in my assessment of the team. And you know, there are times where like maybe those two things butt heads, but I'm not here to make personal enemies. I'm not here to like pick petty feuds. I think in many ways that's why I don't give a shit about like, you know, maroon, shades of maroon on uniforms or like Massachusetts for, you know, like there's just certain things. It's like, I'm not going to, that's their job. They have a hard job. I think most of the ones I do know in that department, by the way, most of them are doing a really outstanding job and work really hard, and a lot of it's thankless work. So like, I have no interest in litigating like, you know, whether or not some, like, they deal with that in house. If there's something egregious, I'll call it out. But they've got a hard job, and I'm not here to, you know, make their life more difficult. But I'm also like not here to just like blow smoke and say everything's hunky dory when it's not. So I hope I've been able to keep that, and I hope anyone who listens to the show who feels I'm not doing that would let me know. I'm always open to fair criticism. Sloven, friend of the show, says, who are the starting five next year? I would say, if I had to right now, knowing nothing about who's there next year, I'll say Carl Pierre, Keon Clairgeau, DeJiri Baptiste, Jonathan Laurent, and Samba Diallo. I would like to see both those guys in the lineup in a perfect world. And I would actually really like to see the lineup I just mentioned. He says, who does UMass beat in the Atlantic 10 championship? I'm not even going to conjecture on that right now. Is everyone following Coach Carville on Twitter? They should be. That's been his Sloven's mission for some time now. Why did Tyler O'Day make his Twitter private? I have no idea. Tyler, of course, UMass diehard and employee of Barstool Sports. And finally, he says he's guaranteeing a win tomorrow against Dayton, and he's bringing in secret weapons JB Mills, Nader Mills, and Coach EJ Mills. Coach EJ Mills is the football coach at Amherst College, longtime football coach there, has been very successful. And I presume JB Mills is his son. And I remember Sloven telling me sometime back that they are a Dayton family. So he's probably joking. He's probably talking a little trash there. Dan Mayo, good friend of the show, not as active on UMass Twitter, but a good follow, at Dan_MAIO. He says, I've always been curious about the cadence of the podcast. Is there a cadence, or do you just do them when you feel like it? So I guess when you say, when I think of the word cadence, I think of, well, I guess, yeah, timing, yeah. But I think of it like more like verbally, and like your cadence is when you talk rather than timing. But, I'll be candid. Cal's kind of disappeared, as you know. And I don't think he's even watching the team much. He checked in like a week or two ago. He's been busy and like he's been following the hockey team a bit. But so that sort of changed things a little. I work later. And that actually was true last year too. But that's made me just more and I've been very busy at work. So I've been just tired at points. And then there was that stretch where I was just like, I'm not doing a show until we win again. Because it was just depressing. And I didn't have anything terribly interesting to say other than, well, you know, it would have been maybe too much on the critical side. And Bennett's been busy too. So it's just hard to get it all together. And with a little kid and all that stuff too. I mean, and I think, like, let's be honest, if they were 27-0, we'd be doing a show every other night. Like, you know what I mean? You find time. But yeah, it's been a little tough. And I apologize for that. I think we've been a little better lately, but and then there's been a couple instances where I've actually recorded like a mailbag segment and just forgot to send it to Bennett or something happened the next day. This is kind of a bummer because I'm recording Monday night and the game is Tuesday this week, which kind of sucks. So there's just stuff in the schedule and yeah, just life gets in the way. I would like to commit, you know, next year or whatever to the same time, but Bennett sometimes works irregular hours. Lately, I've just been recording it myself and sending it to him to kind of upload and cut up. We haven't actually like talked on, he hasn't been here with me for a while. So apologies about that because I miss him too. But it's also become a little bit easier for me to record. And I hope the sound's gotten a little better. And then he also asks, oh no, this was another conversation. Finally, Brian Winslow, good friend of the show. What, in your opinion, has been Matt McCall's biggest strength and weakness to date? I think his biggest strength is, and it's seemingly taken for granted, but I think it shouldn't be, his ability to stay super passionate and engaged, particularly throughout games all year. You've even heard players say it in interviews that like his energy is remains through the roof no matter what. And that's really, really not easy when you're struggling the way in which UMass is, particularly during that stretch where to open A-10 play when they were 0-6, despite like defending really hard and just couldn't catch a break. So I think his biggest strength is just staying locked in and you know, focused on keeping that energy on a team where that I think I think some of these guys on this group are not the highest energy guys, put it that way. So I think that makes it even more demanding for Matt to stay that way throughout the year. And I think his biggest weakness, frankly, to this point, recruiting, whether that's a matter of his staff hires or whether that's a matter of just having to kind of quickly get 4 transfers when he first got here because of all that happened. I think that, you know, to varying degrees, there's a lot of imperfections with each of these guys. And it's very conceivable that one or two of them who are transfers may transfer again, you know, that remains to be seen. So, you know, ultimately, I think probably that. And maybe the second weakness would be just, I think that's it. That should do it. That went way longer than I was expecting. I sincerely apologize, and I had fun doing it. So go UMass, and we'll talk soon. Peace.